welcome to a special bonus episode of the Catalyst podcast. Today, I will be speaking to Tom Eiselman, who is a professor of entrepreneurship at Harvard Business School and has just written a book entitled The Fail-Safe Startup, which looks at the reasons why the vast majority of startups fail. Tom, welcome to the show.
Ken, it's great to be here. Thank you for hosting.
No problem at all. And firstly, Tom, I just want to say that I've just finished a book and what a great read it is, not just in terms of content, but also in terms of the writing style. I found that once you start reading chapter one, you're off on this whirlwind journey right to the final page. So well done on that. It kept me engaged all the way through.
Thank you for that. I had a couple of great editors helping, so I'd like to take all the credit, but it's a team.
So to kick off, an obvious first question, Tom, is what made you want to write a book that focuses on failure? And if I can throw another question on the back of that for the benefit of our listeners, how did you define failure?
Yeah, I'll do the catalyst first. And that was the failure of a team that I'd worked very closely with. In fact, they were former students. I'd encouraged them to launch the startup. I was an investor. And they did pretty much everything right at the beginning. A lot of what we teach at Harvard Business School about testing demand for the business, they did that. They validated demand. They raised money, launched the business, raised $1 million, tried to raise $1.5 million, and that's part of the failure story. And within a year, they had failed. They'd run out of cash and couldn't raise more. And I could point to a lot of problems, but I couldn't pinpoint the cause. And in my line of work, this is one of the most important phenomena in my field. Something like 2/3 of startups fail. And here I was a failure at explaining failure. So that was the catalyst, the motivation to go off and learn everything I could. And that was years ago, 8 years ago. And it's been lots and lots of speaking to failed founders and investors and survey work and reading everything I could get my hands on. And here we are 8 years later. We move slow in academia.
Indeed. And I suppose the question is, how did you define failure? Because I suppose failure means many things to many different people. I suppose you have to define that before you start.
Yeah, if you go to the dictionary, it's not terribly helpful. Failure is a shortfall relative to expectations. And that begs the question, which expectations and whose expectations? And that sort of takes you on a quest to answer both. And you might expect we'd look at the founders, the entrepreneurs' goals. Some of them want to build personal wealth. Some of them just want to build a great business, sort of prove they can do it, build a team. And in fact, founders' goals are important. And I pay a lot of attention to them in the work. But it turns out that if you look at scaling startups, startups that have had some measure of success and actually are starting to grow, only 40% of them are still led by a founder about 5 years out. The rest, the 60%, we've had the founder replaced by a professional CEO. So you can't just look at the founder's priorities because there are a lot of stakeholders here. The definition I use in the book is investors did not and never will make money. And the never will part is important because some startups can actually generate enough cash to survive, but never enough cash to generate a positive return for the investors. And at least by the investors' yardstick, that's a failure, and I think a real one. I mean, even though the company survives and people have jobs and the product is out there, we'd want to also, if we're looking at stakeholders, ask about society at large. You know, it turns out that a venture can be financially successful and do things that we as society wish wouldn't happen. Pollution, addictive products that exacerbate income inequality like some of the gig economy businesses out there. So we do have to stretch the definition a little bit beyond just the investors. And likewise, a company can fail by the investor yardstick but generate spillover benefits for society that the investors don't realize, but we all enjoy. You send out workers who've been trained to do something useful, and they apply that skill and those perspectives to the next business they work in. Or the entrepreneur shows other entrepreneurs what not to do, and there's actually value in that. So like so many things, academics love to parse definitions, and here I've parsed it, but it is complicated and less straightforward than people might think.
And leading on from that, Tom, one thing that surprised me at the start of the book was how high the failure rate was, not just for early stage, but also in late stage companies as well.
Yeah, I wouldn't say startled, but quite surprised. So early stage startups, and my universe here is part because it's easy to measure, and failure is hard to measure. It's really hard to put your thumb on the pulse of the broad set of new businesses launched all over the world. So we can't get a look at venture capital-backed startups. And in the U.S., something like two-thirds of them fail if you've raised venture capital at the early stage, and still one-third fail if your definition of is investors didn't make money. Later-stage startups, say 5 years out and further, still one in three don't make money for the investors, and that's troublesome. And by the way, they fail for very different reasons than the early stage startups.
Interesting. And I suppose now moving on to maybe why they fail at whatever stage they're at. You know, going into the main body of the book, your research revealed six really distinct startup patterns that explain why the vast majority of startups, you know, struggle and fail. Three of these are focused on the early stage, if I remember correctly, and three of those are focused on the latter stage. So if we could maybe kick off with the early stage, if you could kind of cover those three patterns. I seem to remember names like false starts and false positives coming to mind. So if you can go through the three early stage hurdles or failure patterns, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah, thank you. In fact, the book's divided into early stage failure patterns and late stage failure patterns. So early stage, just to be clear, this is a venture that's just getting started, still trying to figure out if the vision, the product, will meet the needs of customers. And a false start is probably the number one killer of early stage startups. And here, we're thinking exactly as you would in track and field or in swimming, where the athlete in an effort to get an edge on the competition literally jumps the gun and gets penalized as a result. So an entrepreneurial false start is the entrepreneur moving as fast as they can to build and launch the product, and in the process skipping some upfront research steps that are really important to figuring out if you actually have identified a promising opportunity. Have you got a strong unmet customer need in your sights? And by the way, there's almost always many ways to solve a problem if you've identified a good problem. And good designers will explore without actually building the product through prototypes, will explore those solutions and not move too quickly to embrace just one of them. The entrepreneur, the identity of an entrepreneur is somebody who makes things happen. And so it feels good to just get started, just do it. And it feels like you're being a good entrepreneur. And many of these entrepreneurs, some listeners will be familiar with the lean startup movement. This is the idea of stating assumptions and running tests to validate the hypotheses, the assumptions. And so these entrepreneurs who fall victim to a false start are actually doing what lean startup practitioners want them to do, which is put a product in the hands of real customers, get feedback from those customers, and pivot away from a flawed solution if the feedback says you're off track. That's only part of lean startup, though. That's a very important part, and those entrepreneurs should do that. But they've skipped the other half, the early half of lean startup, which is what Steve Blank, lean startup guru, calls customer discovery. Get out of the building, he exhorts people. Talk to potential customers before you start building. Figure out if you've got a problem worth solving, and then explore many solutions. So these entrepreneurs, they have probably cost themselves 4 months, the amount of time it takes to pick a number, to build the product, launch the product, figure out if it's working, and then figure out what to do next if it's not working. And they've traded those 4 months for 4 weeks that they are skipping before they start the engineering work. It's a bad trade. And if you've only got, if you're bootstrapping and you've only got a year's worth of runway of money in the bank to support yourself while you're trying to build this business, if you waste 4 months out of 12 on a flawed version of the product that could have been better if you just spent 4 weeks up front, you've made a bad trade.
And I can see how that happens quite easily. You start your own business, and dependent on where you came from before, whether you work for a large company and made the jump, or you're young and you're starting from fresh, there is that keenness, pressure, expectation. And I'm talking even within your own peer group and family to make a start.
Yeah, exactly. Entrepreneurs make things happen. What could be more natural than just getting going? And the vision is burning bright for so many entrepreneurs. They think they can see around corners. We need them to be overconfident. You have to be a little bit crazy to do this in the first place. So their confidence propels them. And it's very true, by the way, of technical founders, meaning people with an engineering background. They love to build. So, you know, it's natural for them. But even many of the MBAs I work with are not technically trained, but they hear correctly over and over again, you need great product to succeed as an entrepreneur. How do you get great product? You have great engineers, and they're good at networking. So they go off and find a technical co-founder, or they scrape together enough money to outsource the engineering work. And so whether you're technical or non-technical, there's this lot of pressure to move fast and get going. And the advice for entrepreneurs is slow down. We're not talking about spending a year studying the market. It's really just weeks. If you're convinced you've got the vision, it feels like a waste of time, but you probably don't.
Mm. And what about false positives?
Yeah, we've all learned, unfortunately, too much about false positives in the last 14 months. Same thing for entrepreneurs. They're vulnerable to false negatives and false positives. False negative is tragic for an entrepreneur. It's a signal that your opportunity is a bad one when, in fact, it was a good one, and you may throw in the towel, shut the thing down, and then 2 years later read about some entrepreneur who just took the thing public for $1 billion, and you're like, oh, I could have done that. That's the false negative. The false positive is a signal that your thing is working really well, and it may be with early adopters. There's often a set of customers out there who are waiting for you and your product, and they love what you do. They're foaming at the mouth with enthusiasm for what you do, and they tell each other, and the business grows early through word of mouth, and they buy your thing over and over again. The entrepreneur can get seduced by that early success and assume that success will carry forward to the next wave of customers, the mainstream, the much, much bigger set of customers. You, of course, need these early adopters to get the business going, but most businesses need mainstream customers too. And it's quite often the case that their enthusiasm is less, or more importantly, their needs are actually different. It's often the case that the early adopters are sophisticated and have different needs. And if you move aggressively in their direction and tailor your product for them, you may have over-engineered a product for the mainstream. And so the false positive sends the entrepreneur in the wrong direction, in the direction of the early adopters, prematurely, sometimes with the wrong product. Once you've moved in that direction, it's difficult to course correct. It takes a lot of energy to move the venture back where it should be, or slow it down.
Mm. And again, I can this picture there. And I forget the company you used as an example in the book around false positives.
That's a Baru. I love the name of the company, so I'll do a detour here for the listeners. A Baru is when a dog perks up its ears and tilts its head in response to a human voice. It's the perfect name for a pet care service provider. And Baru was exactly that. And their trick was they were going to market their services through apartment buildings. So people would move in from another part of town or another city, and they wouldn't have a dog walker. And the concierge or the doorman in the building would say, use Baru. And that would work. And it turned out the first building that they worked in was a giant apartment building in Boston that had 400 units. It was the old headquarters of a failed newspaper, sort of converted into condominiums, and all on the same day filled up. And it turned out many of the apartments were filled up with a Hollywood production crew that was shooting a movie in Boston for months and months. They were on per diem. They were working 15-hour days. They brought their dogs from Los Angeles. We had unbelievably 3 meters of snow in 30 days the month that this business launched. So everybody who had a dog wanted somebody's help in walking it through all that snow. So the demand was spectacular for the first customer for Baru. And other buildings in Boston heard about this. They pounded on Baru's door, come and work with us too. The entrepreneur who thought she was going to slowly grow the business, avoid venture capital, take a little bit of money from angels, get Boston profitable before she moved to a next city, suddenly thought, wow, I can go raise venture capital. And she prematurely expanded in Boston and then jumped quickly to Chicago and just couldn't handle the pace of expansion.
Wow.
False positive.
Indeed. And then the third pattern, which I love the name of, is good idea, bad bedfellows.
Yep, this is a sad one. This is actually the business that the catalyst that motivated the work in the first place, Quincy Apparel. And here the idea is sometimes entrepreneurs do have a good idea, and maybe they've run the lean startup experiments, the minimum viable product tests and so forth, to prove that, in fact, there's demand for this. In this case, the idea, these were two former students of mine, tall women, had trouble finding clothing that looked good for work and fit them well. And so they were going to, that was the idea, they were going to create affordable, stylish, and here's the key, better fitting work apparel for young professional women. And that turns out to be really difficult to do. And neither of them had worked in apparel design and manufacturing before. Two MBAs often struggle with the question of who's going to be the CEO. They both are qualified and both aspire to the role. So best friends, they agreed, we're not going to let conflict over the business get in the way of our friendship. So they couldn't sort out, and they had to talk through every decision, which slowed them down. Because they lacked skill, the knowledge of the apparel business, they hired industry veterans out of big apparel companies, and there are many, many specialized tasks in apparel production and design, fabric sourcer, pattern cutter, quality control, et cetera. And they, all these things have to fit together and hand off the work from step by step by step. They didn't know what this process was. They made the mistake of hiring people out of big companies. In an early stage startup, everybody's a generalist, and they will dive in and to put out whatever fire is burning hottest, you know, like six-year-olds on a football pitch, you know, all swarming around the ball. And these employees said, I'm the pattern maker. I have no idea how to solve the problem that's burning over there. And they sat on their hands. So bad bedfellows. The founders weren't the right founders for the job. The team members weren't the right team members. They had trouble attracting enough capital from the right investors. People could actually give advice and leverage contacts. And then it turns out a small apparel company will often outsource manufacturing to a third-party factory. And these factories didn't pay much attention to Quincy Apparel. It was a peanut, a tiny business. They had no industry relationships or reputation, so their orders just kept getting pushed to the back of the production queue when somebody bigger needed an order expedited. So it was a good idea. The product sold. There were repeat purchases. The sales were growing, but they just could never get everything together fast enough. And investors lack the confidence to say, you're going to fix these problems quick enough for us to actually see a return on further investment.
And I think that's the thing about the book, because having gone through the great examples in it, at the start of each one, I remember thinking, that's a good idea. That's clever. And you read it thinking, oh, maybe this is going to be one that succeeds. Because even though you know it's about failure, I remember reading the one about the apparel company that you just described, and it just turned into a perfect storm. And I thought, I dread to think what they were going through emotionally when it got to the latter part of that journey, when everything was falling down and it just got worse and worse and worse. But the thing is, each of them, you could, if you would have said at the start, do you think this will succeed? You'd say, well, there's a problem there and you're solving it and this could go big and there's lots of reasons why it would scale.
Yeah, that's the key. And I think that's why the book can be helpful to entrepreneurs. So I deliberately excluded two types of failures that are out there. There are businesses that are just terrible ideas and entrepreneurs, aspiring entrepreneurs who are just ill-suited temperamentally for the role. And those businesses fail, and they fail fast. And the good news is no one, they have trouble recruiting a team, so we haven't hurt a lot of other people in the process. And that entrepreneur will learn a lesson, and hopefully they won't try it again. There's not much to say about those businesses. They're sad, but people do make the mistake of trying to be entrepreneurs with a bad idea when they shouldn't. At the other end, there are many, many, particularly in the wake of COVID, businesses that fail for reasons that are completely out of control of the entrepreneur. I mean, COVID wiped out worldwide probably millions of young businesses, certainly hundreds of thousands. And we can't blame the entrepreneur in this case. So there's, again, not much to say. It's tragic. We could feel for them, but there's not much we can do. You can't say, you know, look out for a pandemic and try to not launch your business for the next 3 years isn't very helpful advice. So the focus in the book is ventures that initially showed promise, good ideas, smart entrepreneurs attracting smart team members and smart investors, but something goes wrong and in ways that are preventable.
Yes, and in relation to your comment now about some of these companies disappear off the radar and you don't notice necessarily they've gone, or you weren't even aware they were there in some cases. Now we go to the other side of the coin, which is the later stage companies, where if they do go under, Then I think there's a lovely term you use about a smoking, my memory fails me today. There's a term you use about what's left off.
A giant steaming crater in the landscape. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you only know about the early stage failures if you know the entrepreneur or somebody who works there or you were unlucky enough to be an angel investor. But the big ones, you know, I'm sure that news of Theranos, for example, reached your side of the Atlantic, and you know, $1 billion of investment. Yeah, so these are painful because there are hundreds of employees, maybe thousands involved, and often hundreds of millions of dollars of investment that have gone into the company. And when they fail with a crash.
And in your book, again, you pick out three key patterns behind why these latter stage companies fall over.
Speed trap, help wanted, and cascading miracles are the patterns.
Great names.
Thank you. The speed trap is the big one here. This is a business that's off to a great start and can't sustain the momentum. Tries to, spends aggressively on marketing to keep the growth going. And so what happens when you get that early growth, several things happen. Investors are attracted and they will put in money at a very high share price under the expectation that the growth will continue. That's what venture capital investors are looking for. They want growth. They want something to grow fast and grow big. And the entrepreneur doesn't need her arm twisted, right? Most entrepreneurs love to grow too. It's how many of them keep score. And so, but at the same time, the early success often attracts rivals, clones. Sometimes big companies wake up and see that a startup is doing something interesting in their space. And so the next wave of customers, after you've raised this money, you're expected to spend it. You're going to spend it on marketing. Turns out to almost always be harder to get the second wave of customers, right? So they're intrinsically less interested in the business than in the product than the early adopters. So you may have to discount, take your price down. Whereas the first customers may have come just through word of mouth referrals, now you have to spend money on marketing, advertising to attract, promotion. So you're getting a squeeze between what a customer is worth and what it costs to acquire them. And the investors will put up with that for a while. Everybody's confident that we can somehow turn the thing around and improve the economics. Meantime, bad things can be happening inside the company. If it's a pure software business, it may scale easily. But most businesses have humans who do things, pack boxes, answer telephones, answer emails. And if you have to hire a lot of humans and train them in a company that didn't have them before and didn't have middle managers who could coordinate their work and didn't have systems to keep track of the work, all that has to be put in place. You have to hire, you have to create the organization structure, hire the middle managers, put in the information systems. It feels like bureaucracy to an entrepreneur. So they will often resist this move and resisting to the point where it may get chaotic. And culturally, you can have problems too, conflict between the old guard, the employees who were present at the creation, love the founder and the mission, and the new guard specialists who feel their contributions aren't being appreciated. So there's all sorts of bad things that happen with the speed trap, and eventually investors lose patience and flee the scene, won't put more money in, and the things can unwind very quickly when that happens.
And then the next one is help wanted, which I found particularly interesting.
Yeah, help wanted is help of two types, and either type can hurt a company when they both happen together. Problems both happen; it can kill a company. And these are companies who, in contrast to the speed trap, where the fit between the product and the market is dissipating as the company grows, with help wanted, you actually have continued strong demand. And the help is needed in one of two ways. Sometimes it's a missing manager in a key function. And the case study in the book is Dot and Bow. And Dot and Bow is an online retailer of home furnishings. So if we look around ourselves, anybody listening, at the chairs, the tables, all of that came from someplace and it was shipped to wherever you're sitting from someplace. And if you do this online, you know, shipping the stuff from Asia to the West Coast of the United States in the first place, and then on to Kansas City. If your books from Amazon arrive 2 days early, you're delighted. If your couch arrives 2 days early and sits on the street while you're at work, after we get back to work post-COVID, you have a big problem. And so this company, the entrepreneur, knew a lot about generating demand, had a strong marketing and media background, but didn't know anything about operations or logistics, and made three mistakes, actually took three tries to hire a vice president of operations who could actually handle the shipping and put the right information systems in place to keep track of the operations. The third time was the charm. They actually got it right. But in the meantime, they'd burned through a lot of cash, so they had to raise more. And just as they were trying to do it, the capital markets for e-commerce startups shut down in the United States, probably around the world, basically because a couple of companies had had bad results and people just, even healthy companies, I mean, we use the expressions, probably came from the UK, baby out with the bathwater. Healthy companies at a time like this find it difficult to raise capital, and that's what happened to Dot and Bow. So a 1-2 punch of not having the right manager followed by not being able to raise money because investors had lost confidence in the whole sector. Help wanted.
And I suppose that second punch, they were quite vulnerable when they received that second punch.
Yeah, exactly. And to keep going, they had a loan. The loan was collateralized with all the inventory, which they could sell. Right? They owned these lamps and chairs and tables and so forth. So the bank called the loan. And the only way to pay them back was to liquidate the inventory. And when you do that, your business is gone.
Yes. And one, moonshots and miracles, felt quite positive, the actual term. I was intrigued by this one as well.
Yeah, the failure pattern, my editor changed the chapter title. That chapter was always called Cascading Miracles. And these are businesses that are audaciously bold in their scope and ambition. Think of Tesla or SpaceX, Elon Musk's business. These are moonshots, and they required a cascade of miracles. These are successes. I'll tell you about some failures. And what's true of businesses like this is the product development cycle by its nature is very long because you're doing something so bold and so new. Sometimes there's new science. Sometimes there's a lot of engineering work. A long cycle means a lot of capital. Customers have to change their behavior in fundamental ways. You know, NASA has to be comfortable contracting out its space shots to a for-profit firm. That's a big behavioral change for the customer. Sometimes incumbent companies have to come along for the ride, and they've profited from the status quo. You have to raise large amounts of capital, sometimes government regulation for the product in question. Another example of this, I'm sure a lot of listeners will be familiar with the Segway, the sort of personal transporter, two-wheeled thing, gyroscope stabilized. Moonshot, for sure, had enormous ambitions originally. It wasn't clear whether you could ride one in the street. Did it have to stay on the sidewalk? So the regulatory regime for the Segway, or if you're launching satellites and you want to do internet connectivity anywhere on the planet. And so each of these is an uncertainty. You can sort of flip a coin and figure out what are the odds. You know, a lot of these 50-50 uncertainties, and if there are five of them, the chance of flipping heads, getting a good outcome five times in a row, any bad outcome is enough to kill the company. So you need all good outcomes. And five heads in a row turns out to be a 3% chance, same as the chance of spinning a given number on a roulette wheel. And so some of these ventures do survive. We have SpaceX and Tesla, but more of them, like Segway, fail. And the case study in the book in question here is a company called Better Place, which had in 2010, before we had many electric cars, just one, a Tesla, by the way, at that point, the Roadster, little sports car, had the concept we needed these electric vehicles and they need to be charged because their range was limited. So they wanted to blanket the planet with charging stations for electric cars, including robotic stations where a car with a depleted battery would drive in and a robot would pull out the battery and pop in a fresh, fully charged one in 5 minutes. And they raised $900 million, deployed the stations in Denmark and Israel, and couldn't make it work. It was just too bold. And the cascade of miracles didn't happen for them.
And in the cascade of miracles or the moonshots miracles, whatever the term, I think there's quite a big correlation, if I remember correctly, between those kind of companies and very charismatic, founders or CEOs? Because sometimes that's what takes them down the line.
Think of Elon Musk, so charismatic. I don't know if television program Saturday Night Live makes it to your side, but he just hosted, this is one of the most popular comedy shows in America, and hosted, usually hosted by comedians, entertainers. We had Elon Musk, crazy CEO, as the host just last weekend. Charisma, basically because you have to, like the Pied Piper, get a bunch of people to follow you, and you have to paint a dazzling, mesmerizing vision of the future that people are so excited about following. So the charisma helps. It turns out that these charismatic founders are often just one step removed from cult leaders. And the line between cult and entrepreneurial vision can be a blurry one. And sometimes the founder can get so caught up in their vision and so persuaded that they're right that they fail to see the need to adapt and pivot to something different. That happens. And particularly, charisma often goes side by side with narcissism. And narcissists are famous for, first off, being engaging and persuasive at the beginning, but not listening and only want to get their counsel from a reflecting mirror, basically yes men in their presence. Yeah. That's dangerous.
The Emperor's New Clothes comes to mind as well, that kind of...
Exactly.
So Tom, that's the six patterns that you identify in the book. And as I say to everyone, please read the book because there's so much more in there on top of what Tom's gone through. It's a really great read. Just a couple of questions before we wrap up, Tom. One thing that kept going through my mind when I was going through the patterns was it always six? Or did you have a seventh, eighth and ninth pattern, or maybe more? Did a few potential patterns not quite make the final cut?
Yeah, Ken. So one of the messages of the book to an entrepreneur is think like a designer. And I don't mean an interior designer, sort of picking out the wallpaper. I mean a product designer. And product designers are famous for generating lots and lots of ideas and lots of solutions. And I did exactly that at the beginning in 2014 when, as I said, it took a long time for the book to come together. The first outline of the book was in 2014. I had 50 failure patterns. And I had a vision for the book that would be, you know, 200-300 page book, you know, with a page or two on each of
different,
the 50.
Different volumes.
Yeah. Volume one. And what designers do is they narrow. And so I would, you know, the kind of book I wrote wants to have 10 or so chapters. So that means six or seven failure patterns. And yeah, I did combine a lot of things. You can sort of take the bad bedfellows pattern, for example, and bust it into pieces. So, you know, sometimes it's co-founder conflict that really tears a company apart. The founders just can't agree with each other. Sometimes it's, listeners will be familiar with Moby Dick, great American novel of the Ahab, the possessed whale hunter, chasing Moby Dick across the Pacific. Sometimes entrepreneurs are so insistent on getting a partnership with a big company that they think will define their venture, that they will spend just an enormous amount of energy chasing that partner. And a spoiler alert for your listeners, if you've never read this 800-page novel, it doesn't end well for Ahab when he finally catches Moby Dick. So, and that's true with a lot of entrepreneurs pursuing partnerships with big companies. Yeah, so almost all the patterns I have can be broken into pieces and batch together similar kinds of problems.
And at the end of the book, Tom, you had this chapter, if I remember, entitled Letter to a First-Time Founder, which I thought was a really nice way to finish the book. Can you explain that a bit more to our listeners? Why you decided to have that kind of finish to the book?
Yeah, thank you. I was speaking really to a lot of my past and future students with this letter. And the theme of the letter is, hey, aspiring entrepreneur, you've taken the plunge. You're going to get a lot of advice. There's a lot of conventional wisdom about what makes for a good entrepreneur. And by the way, most of it's good advice. It's sound. Most of the time, not all of the time, and followed blindly, a lot of this advice can actually get you into trouble. And so just to sort of cite a few examples, grow. Entrepreneurs are all about growth. Focus. A new entrepreneur will hear that all the time. Be persistent. And be frugal because your resources are limited. If you're too frugal, you may not hire the specialist, the vice president of operations, you need to ship your couches. If you're too persistent, your persistence may turn into stubbornness and you may fail to see that your idea isn't working and it's time to pivot. So if you grow too fast, the wheels may come off. It may be actually difficult to profitably sustain the growth and you may get chaotic operations inside the company. So all of it sort of culminates in the big advice that entrepreneurs often get, which is to trust their gut, to trust their instinct. And indeed, making decisions fast gives an entrepreneur an edge. It's very important. But there are a set of important decisions that the entrepreneur has to make that shouldn't be made split second on a gut instinct, because your gut will be racked by emotion, and it's hard to make sound decisions if the emotions are sort of stirring up your hormones. And in those cases, the advice to the entrepreneur, first-time entrepreneur, is slow down and take time to think through the pros and the cons, write it out, sleep on it another night, talk to a lot of people who understand you and your business and get advice from them, and don't be too quick to trust your instinct.
So a last question, Tom, before we finish, and I want to kind of finish on a positive in a way. Not that it isn't positive, but you know, I like to kind of finish on a positive if I can. Final question is, you mentioned in the book how founders can fail well. Can you explain that a bit more?
Yeah, that's part three of the book. So part one is early stage failure and how to avoid it. Two, late stage, how to avoid it. If you have done your best to avoid it, but you're still failing, there's two things that you need to do to fail well. And one is to time your shutdown properly. Many of the entrepreneurs I spoke to say that the failed founders that I spoke to, in retrospect, they wish they had shut down sooner. And there's a whole bunch of pressure on an entrepreneur to keep going. They want to be persistent because that's what entrepreneurs are. People are counting on them. There's a whole bunch of moves they have to try. So it's important to think through, have you run out of moves? Is your passion still there? And quite crucially, this is another part of failing well, can you time your shutdown so that you fail gracefully? And by that, I mean people who are owed money are paid the money. Employees receive their salary. Vendors who've shipped you something are paid back. Your investors won't get all their money back, but they'd love 20 cents on the dollar. It's better than zero. And so that's all about managing the shutdown well. And then having failed, the second part of failing well is healing, which is this is incredibly painful. Your identity is wrapped up with the venture, so your ego has been destroyed. Your personal finances may be in a shambles if you've put all your money into the venture. You've probably trashed your relationships because you've ignored your friends for the last 4 months. So it's time to repair all that, time to physically and emotionally heal. And you do that by alternating between rumination on what went wrong. You can't avoid that, but you don't want to spend 100% of your time ruminating, and finding some distractions. And eventually the emotions will subside. Then it's time to learn. And unfortunately, a lot of failed founders don't learn much from the failure. And they do this, they follow the very natural human ego defensive predisposition to blame others, not yourself. But in fact, my co-founder dropped the ball. My investors pushed me to do something that didn't make sense. You picked the co-founders, you picked the investors, so you bear some responsibility. So you want to avoid being the founder that's at the extreme of either taking no responsibility for what happened or too much. And in fact, what we've found is if founders have failed gracefully and preserved their relationships and reputations, and if they can show others that they've learned from the experience, take responsibility for what happened, and most importantly, say what they would do differently next time, then in fact, they're quite well positioned to do it again, to launch another business. Investors will respond well. Team members will join the team and so forth. So all of the entrepreneurs that I studied in the book bounced back stronger and either are entrepreneurs again and doing well or have gone. I mean, some of them are now investors. And it actually turns out if you can look another entrepreneur in the eye and say, I've been where you are and I made mistakes and I think I can help you avoid them, That's actually a good trait for an investor.
And that's great to hear. So some of them haven't kind of been knocked over with the first experience of failure. They're moving on and they've gone on to bigger and better things.
Yeah,
and
they were knocked over, but they got back up and they're stronger now.
Amazing. Well, Tom, I can't believe it. Time has gone. I can't believe we've already gone through the time allowed for the interview. I really appreciate giving your time. It's been an amazing conversation. I've learned so much from it on top of already reading the book. It's fascinating talking to you about this very untouched topic of failure. People generally kind of go past it and move on and think they're immune to it. But it's a great book. I definitely recommend a book to anyone. And Tom, I know you're a really busy man, but thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure and it's been great having you on as a guest.
Yeah, Ken, thank you. And thanks to the listeners. And remember that failure is the best teacher.
If you'd like to find out more about why startups fail, Tom's book is called The Fail Safe Startup and is now available on Penguin Random House. And as I say again and again, it is definitely worth buying. That's it for this episode. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe to this series and please rate us and leave a review on your chosen podcast platform. All contributions are very much appreciated. Thank you.